You're listening to LGRadio.online. Welcome to In the Benny Green Archives.
Good afternoon. November the 27th, 1929. That's a useful date for nominating as a watershed in the history of the musical theatre. Socially speaking, it was a terrible time for doing anything that cost more than a dollar and a half. A few weeks earlier, the bottom had fallen out of America with the Wall Street crash. Even the brokers were going broke. Tycoons were plummeting to solvency from 50th floor windows, and suddenly the last thing investors were thinking about was putting money into musicals. This desperate climate hardly affected a young man who was so rich that, unlike most of his countrymen, even after the Wall Street crash, he still had money he hadn't even spent yet. It was what they used to call old money. That is, family money that hadn't been boosted by stock market speculation, but had been in the family vaults for a long, long time, which by American standards means about 30 years. Indeed, the boy was so rich that he hadn't really bothered till now to do much about Broadway, which was odd, really, seeing that he was terrifically gifted. He had preferred to go wandering about Europe, trailed by a regiment of servants, valets, cooks and dressers who travelled with him in his own train, separate carriages, of course. But in November 1929, after a decade of dabbling and pottering and writing songs for the amusement of his friends, the young man finally made his Broadway mark. Not surprisingly, the show was all about Europe. To be specific, Paris. It was called 50 Million Frenchmen, and was about a rich man, who else, who takes a bet to win the hand of a girl called Lulu, what else, without using his wealth to do it. Well, soon there comes the moment when he tells Lulu he rather likes her. Cue for song.
You do something to me, something that simply mystifies me. Tell me, why should it be? You have the power to hypnotize me. Let me live beneath your spell. Do that you do so well for you. Do something to me that nobody else can do.
Finest love songs that the rich young man ever wrote. He was, of course, Cole Porter, one of the few men who went to Yale and Harvard and got out of both places with his creative powers unimpaired. That 1929 show, 50 Million Frenchmen, announced his ranking as one of the great songwriters. Before that, he had tried and failed, dabbled here and there, seen his name on the bills, but not till 50 Million Frenchmen could he claim to have written a full score for a successful Broadway show. Of course, Porter, being young and ambitious, wrote twice as many songs for 50 Million Frenchmen as there was time for. Instead of the producers doing the usual thing and dropping a number here and there, rejected Porter manuscripts were flying around all over the place. One or two were later retrieved by intrepid researchers. As a lyric writer, he was always very taken with the idea of contrasts in a song. Love and hate, sincerity and cynicism, rich and poor, Human Beings and Critics, and so on. That 1929 show, 50 Million Frenchmen, was the show that really made Cole Porter as a Broadway writer back in the tail end of 1929, around the time that the American economy was hastily converting from caviar to apples. A much more recent reputation, still with us, belongs to the great songwriter who was born on November the 25th, 1900, and all his life had the odd gift of looking very much younger than his years. When I first met Arthur Schwartz, he was well into his 70s, and he could have passed easily for 60. And then I found photographs of him at 60, where he looked about 40. The photographs of him at 40 show a mere boy, so I assume that when they snapped him in childhood, he didn't even come out in the negative at all. Arthur lived in London a lot of the time in his last years and was therefore a rich source of information about his fellow songwriters. As a pianist, he was much better at playing his own songs than other people's. But then, which songwriter isn't? Where Arthur scored was in his ability not so much to play his own songs but sing them. Now, while he wasn't remotely in Johnny Mercer's class, he did have a sort of gentle, unassuming style. Arthur has been much in my thoughts lately because I've been reading a new biography of that amazing character, Libby Holman, the revue singer who became a millionaireess when her rich husband was found one night with so many gunshot wounds that he died of lead poisoning. Nobody ever found out who done it, but Libby never did make much of her career after that and had to be content with a will leaving her $6 million. The interesting and very revealing fact about her career, which founded in a small cloud of dust made by songs of protest and traditional blues, is that Libby, like a lot of girl singers of the period, was just an accident, a natural. Her trouble was that she never understood that. She started studying and then ruined the natural bloom. Over the years, we've all been much entertained by the imbecility of well-known actors who suddenly decide to star in a musical, even though their singing talents put you in mind of that old standard, Froggy with a Wooing Go. And when reporters ask these great thespians how come they're suddenly musicians, the thespians reply airily, oh, they're taking six lessons from some quack who will teach them to do in a couple of weeks what very few even natural singers can achieve in a lifetime. Well, I'm afraid Libby Holman was one of these. In 1934, she was offered the lead in an operetta, which Arthur Schwartz and Howard Dietz were writing, and it was called Revenge with Music. As it was an operetta, Libby decided to go to a singing teacher, and as Howard Dietz put it, ruined her voice completely. Now, fancy going to a singing teacher in the hope of achieving anything remotely like this.
You and the night and the music fill me with flaming desire, setting my being completely on fire. You and the night and the music thrill me, but will we be one? After the night and the music are done, until the pale light of dawning and daylight, our hearts will be throbbing guitars. Morning may come without warning and take away the stars. If we must live for the moment, love till the moment is through. After the night and the music die, will I have away the stars. If we must live for the moment, love till the moment is through. After the night and the music die, will I have
Tonight and the Music, the song that Libby Holman should have done great things by back in 1934, but somehow didn't. That show, or operetta as it was termed, Revenge with Music, never did become really successful. After a run of about 6 months, it closed, and that was that. In his autobiography, Dietz says he asked C.B. Cochran what he thought of it, and Cochran gave him a one-word review. Dire. Still, Revenge with Music remains the only Broadway show whose leading lady had recently been involved in a murder trial. In the Holman biography, there's a lot of very sad stuff about her passion for a much younger man, Montgomery Clift. As the years went by and Clift's youth went with them, he became impossibly morose, and he'd sit for hours alone in a room listening to one performance of one song over and over again. It was this one.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. I got a song that I sing, I can make the rain go anytime I move my finger. Lucky me, can't you see I'm in love? Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let it go. I got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let it go. I got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world.
I got the world on a string, recorded by Frank Sinatra, the recording which became a kind of talisman for poor Montgomery Clift in the years when he was losing his way. You can understand somebody being hypnotized by that recording because it has just about everything. On November the 30th, 1934, an author called Roy Turk died. From his very early years, he wanted to be a songwriter, so in order to achieve this ambition, he naturally took a course in architecture at New York City College. Now, the knowledge he acquired there not only qualified him to write songs, but took him straight into the United States Navy in World War I. While he was in the Navy, Turk performed several deeds of vital importance to naval security, like, for instance, writing special material for Sophie Tucker and Nora Bays. When the war was over, he finally became what he'd really been all the time, a first-rate songwriter, whose best work was done to the music of Fred Arlott.
Mean to me, why must you be mean to me? Gee, honey, it seems to me you love to see me crying. I don't know why I stay home each night when you say you'll phone. You don't, and I'm left alone, singing the blues and sighing. You treat me in the year, you always scold me whenever somebody is near, dear. It must be great fun to be mean. to me. You shouldn't forget, you see what you mean to me. You mean to me, to me. Couldn't be mean if you knew what you mean to me.
In 1930, a show called Strike Up the Band opened. Now, there is a bit of confusion attaching to the two shows of this name. What happened was that the Gershwins wrote the first Strike Up the Band with George Kaufman in 1927. For me, the great cachet of that one was the presence in the cast of Edna May Oliver, who I'll always regard as Betsy Trotwood, and what did she sing, I wonder? Anyway, this first Strike Up the Band was all about how American cheese interests inveigled the Swiss in a war so that America can corner the world's cheese trade. At the final curtain, peace breaks out and the Americans start a new argument over caviar with the Russians. Well, people thought the book a little bit too strong politically for a musical, and the out-of-town tryout was so disastrous with literally empty theatres that the show never came in. 3 years later, Riskin was asked to make the libretto a little bit softer, which he did, apparently, by changing the cheese to chocolate and making the Swiss war a dream inside somebody's head. It worked, 191 performances and a lot of new songs, or rather old songs revamped, rearranged and rejigged.
Soon, my dear, you'll never be lonely. Soon, you'll find I live for you only. When I'm with you, time it is, or what the place, or what the climb it is. Oh, soon our little ship will come sailing home through every storm, never failing. The day you're mine, this world will be in tune. Let's make that day come soon. Found the happiness that I have waited for, the only girl that I was fated for. Safe with all our cares far behind us. The day you're mine, this world will be in tune. Let's make that day come.
please make the day come. Let's make that day come soon. Come soon.
Soon, from the second 1930 Maurice Riskin version of the show Strike Up the Band. Remember that to New York audiences, the show was a brand new one, because in its original form, it had never managed to get into New York State, let alone Broadway. But during the brief run of that ill-fated first show, some of the original tunes had been published. And that meant that when they turned up again in the second version, some of the Broadway audiences would have heard them before. And just to confuse the issue even further, one of the songs in the second Strike Up the Band originally appeared in quite a different show, a 1928 piece called Treasure Girl. And thereby hangs a fascinating tale showing how sometimes the writers of a song know less about how to use it than the artist. Let me quote Ira Gershwin on the subject. Ira says as follows, "This song was sung at a fast tempo in the show and then danced in the fastest 2/4 time I ever heard. For so many years, I thought of the song as exceedingly hot. And then one day, I bought an album, which included the first recording of this number. I listened a while and wondered what the girl was up to. The fast and furious song had become slow and sentimental. But after a third playing, I liked the new interpretation, and apparently so did many others, because I've yet to hear a rendition other than the slowed-up, sentimental one." Close quote. Well, here is the very performance which so remarkably changed the view of George and Ira Gershwin regarding their own work.
How glad the many millions of Tom and Dick and Harry's would be to capture me. But you were so persistent, you wore out my resistance. I fell, and it was swell. You're my big and brave and handsome Romeo. How I've won you, I will never, never know. It's not that you're attractive, but oh, my heart grew active when you I've got a crush on you, sweetie pie. All the day and night time, hear me sigh. I never had the least notion that I could fall. So much emotion. Could you coo? Could you care for a cunning cottage we could share? The world will pardon my mush, 'cause I have got a crush, my baby, on you.
Lee Wiley, slowing down the tempo there, I've Got a Crush on You. And surely that is the song's appropriate tempo. The beautiful trumpet playing was by Bobby Hackett. Anyway, that's it for now. See you same time next week.
Could you coo? Could you care? What a cunning cottage we could share. The world will pardon my, 'cause I've got a crush, my baby, on you.
You've been listening to In the Benny Green Archives here on lgradio.online. Please do visit the website to find out when the next episode is on, along with all our other shows. This is lgradio.online. Thanks for listening.